We're speaking today with Megan Benage. Megan is the regional ecologist in the southern region of the Minnesota DNR, and Megan specializes in prairies. And Megan is also the host of a great podcast called Prairie Pod, and we will let you know how you can access that pod later in the program. But right now, I want to talk to Megan about Grassland Month. July is Grassland Month, and what does that mean?
Well, for one, happy Grasslands Month, John. I would be remiss if I didn't start by saying that. Hooray! It's Grassland Month! So first, it means you should have some cake and not feel guilty about it, because it is a celebration, and all celebrations, good celebrations, start with cake. Gluten-free, your choice. So secondly, what it means is we're just celebrating this wonderful, rich part of Minnesota's natural heritage. So Grassland Month is something that started in 2014 in Minnesota, sort of right after the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan was born, if you will. And that's a plan where it guides our work. It basically was a whole bunch of partners from lots of different organizations who came together and said, you know what? Prairie is important. We want to protect it. We can agree on that. Now how do we do it? And that's largely because we've lost so much of our prairie. I know you never want to start out a celebration with like some depressingness, but here it is. Like we have lost a lot of our prairie. So this is an effort to celebrate what we have left and to make sure that it's here forever and ever and ever and ever.
Is there a significant difference? Is there a definition which separates maybe grasslands from prairies?
Yes, there is a little bit. It's kind of like a square is not a... Wait, a rectangle is not a square, but a square is a rectangle. It's kind of like that. So a prairie fits into a grassland, but there are lots of different categories of grassland, primarily depending on the quality. So a prairie, the way you want to think about that is this is an unbroken, so it's never been broken by a plow, piece of land that has grasses are dominant, obviously, grassland. Grasses are dominant, and that has this rich forb component, or wildflowers. That's a fancy way of saying wildflowers. And so sometimes people forget about that, but wildflowers are sort of, you know, they're this great symphony of color that's bringing in, I guess, the symphony of sound from the birds and the insects. So prairies are probably the truest form of a grassland, or the most rare, the best example of one, the coolest, most diverse. I could go on. Just give me any adjective for good, and that's what a prairie is.
We had a lot of prairie here before the arrival of the Europeans, but our numbers have radically decreased. Now, you said that a true prairie is land that has never been turned over by a plow. Does some of that land exist in Minnesota?
We do. We have a very small percentage of it. So, okay, this is where we like boggle your mind with the numbers. But so Minnesota used to have 18 million acres of prairie. 18 million acres. I can't even comprehend what a million acres of land looks like, let alone 18 million. So a good way to think about it is that prairie used to cover a third of the state. A third. So we are definitely a prairie state. We are in the prairie part of the tallgrass prairie system. So now we have just over 1% left, 1%. So we went from having a third to now we have 1%. So we have roughly 235,000 acres, which sounds like a lot, but we're still losing prairie every day as it gets changed over to other uses. So we really have a fight on our hands to make sure that we conserve it, and so that the things that Laura Ingalls Wilder saw aren't lost. That we can, when we're reading her books, you know, we can envision this landscape, this prairie landscape. So my goal is to get it back in balance. And that's really the challenge, because we're talking about the tallgrass prairie is one of the most endangered ecosystems in the world.
It would seem to me if you had something as rare as a tallgrass prairie that you would be able to not allow it to be turned over by plow or turned into something other than that. Is the problem that it's in private hands, or what's the issue?
No, I think it's the same issue for most things. How do you find balance in any system, right? You have so many different demands on land, and you have so many needs to live that sometimes the very basic things that we need to live, like clean air and clean water, we sort of forget where those things come from and that they do, in fact, come from remnant habitats that are intact, healthy, and functioning at a high level. So I think sometimes we just forget. Really, we owe private landowners a big debt, because that's why we have a lot of the prairie left that we have, is because they made the choice to conserve and protect it. But it's just like anything, if you're facing an immediate need of, I need to feed my family tomorrow, and if I turn it into farmland, I'll get XX dollars, that's a little bit easier to understand and translate into your checkbook than it is to say, oh, this acre of prairie is providing me with this many gallons of clean water and this much fresh air and all of that. Those seem like a little bit more intangible benefits, right? Plus, they don't necessarily impact your paycheck. They certainly impact your quality of life, and they definitely impact your well-being, but we don't always economically value those things the way that they should be valued. And the hard part is you can't expect the little tiny amount that we have left to do it all. So when you start looking at how do we create a stackable, I love stackables, both in my lunch and on the prairie. how do you create a stackable? So like, how do you find grazing, for example, and get that to work in the prairie? Definitely, historically, prairies were grazed by bison and elk and deer, but you're talking about a landscape that used to be a lot bigger. And so now it doesn't necessarily make ecological sense to graze every bit of it because you have so little left. So it's that kind of idea, like how do I find the economic balance points in there, but also make sure that what I'm doing isn't negatively impacting the system.
That's an incredible bit of a problem, really, when you think about it, because there are a lot of factors that go into it beyond grazing, of course. What about fire? Is fire a tool you can use now, or was it a tool in the past? How did fire affect the prairie?
Fire. I love to say, burn, baby, burn. So prairies definitely are disturbance-based habitat, so they don't persist without fire. They need some type of disturbance. And historically, that disturbance came in the form of either fire or grazing. That's how prairies get disturbed. And so now, generally, most people have a good sense of, you know, security and well-being, and they wouldn't really enjoy just having wildfires roaming right next to their neighborhoods. That's generally something that most people aren't super excited about. So we do something now which is called a prescribed or a controlled burn, where we definitely burn the prairies, but we're burning it on our timeline. And so we're kind of making up what that timeline should be instead of letting it happen through a normal natural process. It also wouldn't work the way that it used to, even if we allowed fire to just move across the landscape, because the prairie isn't as connected as it once was. So you wouldn't have those touch points for it to move the way it should move. So you'd basically end up burning a small patch and the fire would go out and you'd be done. So there's a lot more acres that need burns. And fire and grazing, what they're doing is they're stopping succession. A prairie, eventually, its natural course of time, especially when it's small and there's a lot of tree pressure, it's going to go to a woods. In the third of Minnesota that used to be prairie, that would have been happening all across the prairie, depending on when it was burned, when it was grazed, that sort of thing. But you also would have had this vast expanse of grassland that wouldn't have all been turning over to woods as fast as the pressure is on it today, because you had more of it that was connected and it was healthier and able to sort of withstand that change. And the fire, again, could move more easily through it.
Tell us a little bit more about prairie in particular. I mean, if you had a 100-acre plot of prairie, maybe that's too small, but if you had this plot of prairie, what would you expect to find in there? What are some of the interrelationships that occur in a prairie? How delicate are they? How hard are they to create? Just give us a rundown on that.
And I love this question. So many things to unpack. Just a second, I need a bite of cake to unpack all of this. What you find in a healthy prairie, and 100 acres isn't too small, that's a decent sized prairie and something that you can find a lot of really interesting things on. So there are thousands of different species that live in a prairie. Thousands. I know that that's kind of a crazy number because people are like, well, I just saw six. But once you start actually looking for things in the prairie, it's pretty amazing. Because think about it like this. So a climax prairie, just like an old growth forest or a climax forest, has all of these different plants, animals, invertebrates, bacteria, soil, fungi, all of these organisms interacting together to create this complex web of nutrient, moisture, and energy flows. And all of those, while that sounds very fancy and scientific, but those nutrient, moisture, and energy flows is essentially creating food, water, and shelter for what all of those organisms need to survive. And it's doing that without any help because it's at its highest function. It's at its healthiest. It's living its best life, right? So you should be seeing lots of different plants, certainly butterflies, bees. We have over 450 different kinds of bees in Minnesota. And once you start looking for them, I guarantee you will notice more than just fat-bodied bumblebees. You'll start noticing little tiny beautiful blue bees or green metallic bees. They're all over, and it's really the best part about having a remnant prairie is that just the sound that these things make. You step on, there's nothing that should make you more afraid than stepping onto a prairie and having it be silent. So I love when you step onto a remnant prairie that has all of this function working for it, and you just get the grassland birds are calling. If you're lucky, you'll see a tiny green snake in the grass, or maybe you would consider that unlucky, depending on who you are. There's voles that are scurrying around. There's hawks that are looking for lunch. You know, there's just all kinds of things that are happening, and just color. There's so much color. It's just nature's paintbrush went through there, and it didn't miss a beat with the wildflowers and the monarchs, and again, even all the different colors that bees come in. It's crazy. So you'll see all of those kinds of things. And then you asked how do we build it back? What if you're talking about something that's that perfect, that was built that incredible the first time? The thing to understand is that prairies are sort of this enigma for us. I kind of think of them like space. There's a lot that we still don't know. Because when you're talking about thousands of different organisms, we certainly don't know it all. We don't understand how all of those things are connected yet. We don't understand how to build it perfectly back. Here's a really good analogy. So when I was little, I used to pay my brother to build Legos for me because I hated building them, right? Inevitably, I would never give him all of the pieces because I wanted to play with like some of the pieces that were cooler in my room. And so he'd always come in and he'd be really frustrated, like, well, I tried to build the ship, but I'm missing this, this, and this. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I have those right here. So it's kind of like that. You're building a Lego, but in this case, you're missing some of the pieces, and your dog definitely ate half of the instructions. So you're trying to put your heads together with other scientists and other prairie practitioners and figure out, how do I fill in these gaps to build it perfectly how it was first time? So it involves a lot of trial and error. It involves a lot of learning, which is great because I believe once you stop learning, you're dead. So I'm a big fan of learning. And it's just a puzzle trying to figure out how to build it back. It's hard. The other thing that's hard for people is that when you plant a prairie, you get cover right away. Like, so you get some grass that grows and you get wildflowers that grow. And so sometimes people get into this mindset of it's like making a cup of ramen for lunch, where they're like, I want an instant prairie. I want it right now. I want my soup and I want it right now. Well, if you think about it, just like a forest, if you gave me a tree seedling today and I planted it, I'm not going to have an old growth forest tomorrow or next year or even 5 years from now. It's going to take time. And the same is true for our prairies. And the more we allow it that patience and that time, the better off it's going to be. So that's really hard because I also, even though I know these things, when I plant prairies, I'm like, I want it to look like right now. that's not how it works.
So how are you doing? Have you managed to recreate some prairies? Obviously, the timeline is one thing, but have you been able to reestablish some prairies?
We definitely have not been able to rebuild a prairie so that it matches a remnant. But what we have been able to do is reconstruct something that is prairie-like. So it's prairie-like. So it has some of the components, and we're getting some of the functions. The good news is that when you put diversity into the system, you get diversity. So there's lots of research and science that has come out recently that's shown us that the more diversity, like the different kinds of things you have in a prairie, from a plant aspect, the more different kinds of insects that community brings in. And so what is kind of exciting research is that we have shown that when we do that, we are able to match the numbers, for example, of bee species that we see in remnant prairies with reconstructions. So we're still not fully back to the whole, but we're getting some of the pieces right, which is really exciting. And definitely the good news also is that not everything that lives on a prairie needs it to be perfect, which thank goodness, because if it did, we'd be in a whole different world of trouble. So we, by getting that good habitat out there, it may not be the best example, and it may not be perfectly a prairie yet. And to be honest, John, I'm not going to know how close we get to it being a prairie until 300 years from now. Some ecologist then is going to have to let you know how well we did. Because that's just how long these things take to get put back.
300 years.
Or more.
Wow, that's astonishing.
Go ahead.
When you talk about old growth forests, that's what it takes.
Well, right. And so it's kind of like getting us to wrap our minds around that and realize that there really is no such thing as an instant prairie, because you have to let it go through the natural succession first. So the first succession in a prairie is you're going to get a bunch of weeds you don't want. You're going to be real frustrated. And then those weeds, whether you like it or not, are going to be providing great wildlife food. Those are the best. New prairie plantings are the best place to go hunting. I just gave the secret away, because foxtail and other early successional weeds like that, wildlife love those seeds. And so they'll just come in and go. It's a buffet that you've just given them. And then eventually through time, you'll start to see those things drop out as your prairie takes on, the roots deepen, and you start to see even the prairie move through succession. It's another thing that each prairie every year should look different, because every year in Minnesota, we get different rain at different times and we get different weather. I remember last June when we were out in the field, it was glorious. It was like 70 degrees every day. It was absolutely wonderful. This June, it was like, what, 95? and you go outside, and it's like 85% humidity, and you instantly have a tiny mustache made out of sweat. And you're just like, wow, this is not enjoyable. So just like we're going to respond differently to that climate, the prairie does also. And so we need to give it the flexibility to change through time. So different plants in that prairie are going to be dominant one year, and then they'll drop out the next year. And it's all kind of based on what moisture we're getting in the sense of rain and snow, how hot is it. Different plants can thrive in those different environments. And that's another reason why diversity becomes something that's really important, because we don't know what the climate's going to look like from year to year. And because we don't know, we need to make sure that we have the right species in there that can kind of adapt with those changes.
Are there plants that to you tell you this is a prairie, this plant, and they come back year after year? So you see that plant and you go, this is a prairie.
Yes. So there are some plants that we just don't see in reconstructions. We haven't quite figured out how to get them to grow. And what is the magic sauce in the soil that's making them work in a remnant prairie? Lead plant is one of those plants. It's one of our few prairie shrubs. So it's kind of weird to think of as a shrub, because it gets woody on the bottom when you don't burn a prairie. But generally, it's a soft stem. So it's not a hard stem like you would think of most shrubs, you know. So lead plant is purple, and it looks like it's been dusted in lead. It has these kind of bean, mimosa-like leaves that are very large, and you can get pretty tall lead plant. That's why it's a shrub, because it can be, oh gosh, I don't even know how tall, 3 feet, 4 feet, I don't know. It's taller than my waist. It's about Megan waist high, okay, for those of you who can't see me on the radio show and have no idea how tall I am. That should give you a great reference point. But that's a climax prairie species, and we kind of say that it's like an ecosystem in and of itself because it attracts so many different things to it. There are so many different kinds of insects, for example, that use lead plant, but it's one of those that needs the soil connections to be just right. It needs the right biology, it needs the right bacteria, it needs the right fungi, and we don't quite know what that mix or ratio is. But I've seen prairie plantings where we planted lead plant right at the beginning, and I haven't seen it for 12 years after we planted it. But then all of a sudden, in year 12, it's like, hey, look at all the lead plant. It's just one of those that tells you it's a prairie. There's other grasses that will tell you it's a prairie. There's a really adorable one called prairie drop seed. It makes a fountain, and it has really fine hairs like grass. And what I love about it is the seeds kind of smell like buttered popcorn. So it sends up this little panicle of seeds, or this tuft, you know, of seed heads, and it definitely, they smell like popcorn, which I think is great.
When you said earlier that there were a thousand different plants in a prairie, I thought to myself, are 990 of them grass?
No, they're not. So that's the part that people often forget, is there's this rich wildflower component, and there's tons of them. There's way more forbs or wildflowers than there are grass on the prairie. But there's also a lot of grass species. And so it's incredible. I think some of the most interesting things about a prairie that we're trying when we rebuild it is sometimes you'll see a seed mix that somebody's doing and they're saying, oh yeah, I'm doing a prairie planting. I put 20 species in it of plants. And you're like, okay, well, maybe you're just doing a planting. Not the prairie planting, because that's not quite enough species. I think if the DNR were up to about 100, but it's definitely hard to find the seeds, to source them, to get them to grow. There's all kinds of fun science and math that's involved in trying to figure out how to get your seed mix working and how to plant it. Because the way that we plant prairies now, because of how our funding works, we're typically planting them and we get one shot to set the future of that piece of land for the next 100+ years. Because the way our funding works, we're going to get one time to plant it, one time to do the site prep, one time to make it all happen. And as my friends at Fish and Wildlife Service would say, they'd say, okay, Megan, thanks, no pressure.
This is not a problem. You can do this.
They can do it. They can. It's just that you can't be afraid to fail and you can't be afraid to try new things. So I don't know if there are 1,000 species of plants, but there are definitely thousands of species of organisms. So that would include plants and all the wildlife that lives there, like a deer, for example, or a salamander. Now I'm like struggling to think of a specific wildlife, or a vole, or a monarch, or a bee. See, I just need to get on a roll.
Right. Do you have a favorite prairie plant, or maybe a rare one that you, when you stumble on it, you just marvel?
Oh gosh, I don't have just one. I mean, I think I'm like...
You can list more than one.
Well, I'm like most ecologists, and the reason I became an ecologist is because I couldn't decide on just one thing. Because the beauty of ecology is you get to look at all of the different organisms and how they interact with each other. So it also depends on the time of year. I know I'm really evading this question. I will list some plants. Don't worry, listeners. I will list plants. I think I just, every year and every season on the prairie is different. So depending on when I'm stepping out, sometimes it's the collection of plants and the collection of the structure of the prairie and the prairie horizon that really gives me pause and is awe-inspiring to me. So I'm a big fan of purple prairie clover. It's an adorable plant. I also love purple prairie clover pollinating time because the pollen is orangey-red. And so it looks like the bumblebees are carrying around these huge orange sacks on their legs, and it's just adorable. So I love that one. It smells like Christmas. What's not to love about a plant that smells like Christmas? You crush the little leaves, and it has this pine needle orange smell. It smells so good. I really like prairie drop seed, which I said earlier. I think that is just a really neat plant. I know it's a grass, So sometimes grasses are overlooked. I have it planted even around my house. It lines every single flower bed I have. People are probably tired of seeing it. But it makes a great edge plant because it makes this fountain and makes a good natural border. I also have butterfly milkweed, which I love. I like all milkweeds because they're the host plant for the monarch caterpillar. They have to lay their eggs on milkweed, and then the caterpillars exclusively eat that. So I really like to make sure I have host plants, so that way I'm providing for these species that we want to keep around so that other people can get that joy that you feel when you watch a monarch emerging from a chrysalis. Weed, though, because it's orange, and I love orange plants.
You mentioned milkweed, and a friend of mine and another phenologist from up north here, Dallas Hudson, and I came down 2 years ago and took your class. And you had, if I'm remembering correctly, and please help me, green milkweed, a plant that looked, there were two expressions of it, and they were completely different. Is that, do I remember that correctly?
You are, we have taught you well. I can just, I'm just going to just brush my hands together. My work here is done.
Eat your cake.
Eat my cake. There's nothing we need to talk about. You're an expert. No, so green milkweed is a weird, weird milkweed because the two expressions that you're talking about, one has really long, narrow, skinny leaves, and the other one has wide, wavy leaves that looks a lot like common milkweed. So it's a very strange plant because it's one that when we teach people, they're like, you got to be kidding me. This is the same thing. How am I supposed to remember this? Because they just look totally different. So it's like, not only do you need to remember all these other plants that we're teaching you on the prairie, but now you also have to remember that this milkweed is incredibly strange.
You know what? Just the strangeness of it. If I had to go back to the prairie, I would be confident that that was the one plant that I might be able to identify.
Because it was so different.
Yeah. You know, this might be a good time to ask you, what brought you to prairies? Good friends with a bunch of ecologists up here. My friend Harry Hutchins, John Omendinger. These are people that are also ecologists but chose the forest. What made you choose the prairie?
Well, I like to say the prairie really chose me. So it knew it had a friend in me, to quote Toy Story. So when I was in graduate school, or actually when I was an undergrad, and I was looking at going to graduate school, I was working on a prairie reconstruction project at Purdue. And I remember we were sorting the seeds, getting ready to plant a prairie, basically. And we were mixing all of the seeds together so that we would get good rates and get good dispersal across the site. And I didn't even know I was doing this. But as we were sorting these seeds, I was stopping and I was smelling the seeds. And I know that sounds very weird, but, I'm weird. So that's what was happening. I was smelling the seeds, and my mentor just looked at me and said, you're going to be a prairie ecologist. And I said, what are you talking about, Willis? And he was like, well, only ecologists stop and smell the seed like that. He's like, it just smells so good, doesn't it? And I was like, yeah, it's the promise of what's to come. I'm so excited about this. And so then I was just hooked. That was the moment that I fell in love with the prairie, and we've just deepened our relationship, and I think we're at soulmate level now, so I can't imagine another place where I feel more free, where I feel more whole, and I feel more at peace, and that is the magic of the prairie landscape, seeing those waves and waves of a prairie horizon, those waves of grass. It just speaks to your soul, and it's good for your soul. Everybody needs a little bit of prairie right now to help them through. And if you need a little bit of forest, I'm not going to judge you, but I'm going to choose prairie.
Well, I'm glad not to be judged. Unfortunately, I'm in an area of limited prairie accessibility, but maybe you could tell us, our listeners run from far west out Park Rapids way and down to Detroit Lakes. Where could some of us northern forest ecologists go experience some prairies?
I'll give you a couple different options. And another thing to think about before I forget to say it is that definitely check out the DNR's Recreation Compass, because you can search by map there, and that'll help you know where there's some some of your public lands that are close to you where you can see a prairie and recreate, which is really nice. I also love that as you move up the western side of the state and you move north, the prairies change and they're a little bit different with how many species there are. You also pull in something called a brush prairie, which is pretty cool. So a couple ones. All right, let's start sort of central and then we'll go north. Ordway Prairie is definitely one you want to check out. It's owned by the Nature Conservancy, but you can still visit it. This is a huge prairie complex. It's 656 acres. You can definitely get that prairie vista. It's in Polk County, so it's kind of in central, what I would think of as more central Minnesota. I know when you get further north, the center of Minnesota seems to move further north. depending on where you're at. But to me, this is central based on where I work. Then we'll take you to another Nature Conservancy site, the Seven Sisters Prairie. Oh my gosh, this is above Lake Christina. It's about 190 feet above it. And if you have the stamina to walk to the hill at the top, you are going to get just a fabulous look at how the glaciers left the landscape. It's really, really beautiful. And then it's got a hillside that's almost solid sumac that you have to walk through. And sumac is native, but it's interesting because when you look underneath that sumac, you'll see all of these different native prairie plants. And another nice thing about this site is obviously as you move up a hill, it tends to get drier, right? Water goes downhill, generally speaking. So as you move up it, you kind of walk through different types of prairie where you start moving away from mesic or a more medium moisture soil prairie to a dry prairie at the top, which is always really interesting. And when we were there last, we saw a dung beetle, which for some people may not be exciting, but my friend who was with me, she's an invertebrate ecologist, and she just freaked out. She was like, look at him! Look at this guy! Very, very excited to watch him do his work. And it was pretty cool. Dung. So then we'll also take you up to Timpanuckis Wildlife Management Area. This is a DNR property. It's pretty flat terrain, so if I'm describing the Seven Sisters Hill and you're like, no, thank you, ma'am, I only recreate on flat areas with lots of snacks. That is fine. Timpanuckis is for you. It's 840 acres. And then this is where they've got some brush prairie also on it. And it's a really interesting prairie. I think we saw cranes the last time we were there also, so that's pretty cool. So those are just three quick ones, but go check out the Recreation Compass because definitely if you're in the Detroit Lakes area, there are a ton of prairie sites near you that are really interesting. And the other nice thing is you can't just tell on the Recreation Compass. All you can tell is, oh, this is public lands and I should go visit it, right? But you can't necessarily tell whether it's prairie. But you can click on each individual site that you're thinking of visiting, and then that site will tell you about it. It'll tell you if it's prairie or not. And I can't believe I even forgot to mention this. I should, or I'm going to be in big trouble. There's the Glacial Ridge National Wildlife Refuge as well that's up that way. So you could go from Timpanuckis Wildlife Management Area over to the Wildlife Refuge, which is managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And that's a really large chunk of land that contains some prairie in it.
That is wonderful. I can't believe you come up with four great spots. Plus, we'll put up a link on our website to the DNR Recreation Compass so that people can check that out as well. Megan, I want to thank you so much for bringing your passion this morning to the conversation about our Grassland Month, July, and for sharing your cake with us.
Well, I didn't say I was going to share my cake. Let's be serious here. But but I'm very appreciative that you had me on to talk about prairie. I know that you definitely cover usually, and rightfully so, more forest things. But it's really nice to get to see all of the different kinds of habitat that Minnesota offers. It's beautiful to live and work in this state because people really value their natural resources here. They put them first, which also means they're putting themselves first. And if you're interested in more prairie knowledge, you can check out the podcast at mndnr.gov/prairiepod. It's spelled just like it sounds. We thought we were being clever. It's a prairie pod, like a little seed pod of knowledge that we're sharing with you. So we just launched season 3, and new episodes are going to come out every Prairie Tuesday all the way through the end of August.
It's a wonderful podcast. I have been there many times and enjoy each episode. I want to thank you so much for doing the work that it takes to do that and for sharing your love and knowledge of the prairies with us.
Oh, thank you. It's really a partnership effort. It's not about me. It's about everybody in the Prairie Partnership because it takes a village to make all this stuff work for the people of Minnesota. And so I'm just glad that we have a podcast where we get to showcase all the great work everybody's doing.
Megan Benage, an ecologist with the DNR in Minnesota and a very passionate speaker for the prairies.